Welcome to Pod Revisited, episode 67. I'm Tori.
And I'm Shay.
Today we are jumping into chapter 7 of Goblet of Fire, Bagman and Crouch.
Or, as we like to call it, Conspicuous Wizard Camping.
So we are finally kind of moving along in the book to getting to the thing that they've been talking about for, I think, the whole last 6 chapters, the Quidditch World Cup.
Woohoo! It's happening. It's real. It exists.
We're getting there.
So the actual title for this chapter, as you said, is Bagman and Crouch. And I don't know why, but to me, Bagman and Crouch sounds like one of those bad TikTok dances. Like, doesn't it sound like it's the Bagman and Crouch?
We should invent a TikTok dance. So they take the port key in the last chapter with the Diggorys. And so they land where everyone's camping. And there's 2 ministry wizards there to kind of like, I guess, monitor the port keys.
Yeah, and move along the wizards so they don't gather out in public spaces quite as obviously.
The big thing with this is everyone's trying to dress like muggles, but people don't know how muggles dress, so they're in very interesting fashions.
Oh, it's horrendous. It's really, really hilarious. I'm loving the kilt and poncho look one of them has going. I think it's comfortable, it's drafty. I'm not mad about it, especially because, like, a poncho is kind of just, like, a skirt for your shoulders and upper torso. So it's kind of just, like, all skirt. And I think that's breathable. I think that's comfy. I'm not mad at it.
Basil, one of the Minister Wizards that Mr. Weasley seems to know, he talks about being on duty and how Arthur is lucky to not be on duty. So I'm wondering, like, do some Minister Wizards, like, have to participate in the running of this?
I think it depends on the department, right? Like, Mr. Weasley's department is the misuse of muggle artifacts. So maybe if he, like, saw someone misusing a muggle artifact, he could write them up. But, like, sporting events and, like, international wizard relations and stuff like that is not his area of expertise. Yeah. I feel like these wizards are in departments where, like, things like security, things like focusing on the protection of the Secrecy Act that doesn't involve muggle artifacts are all just, like, not his department's job.
Very true.
There are also some more crazy outfits. They described one of the wizards as wearing +4s, and I was like, I have no idea what that is. And in my mind, it was maybe like a mechanics uniform, like a one piece with buttons all the way up. But I had to Google it because, like, I actually don't know. But in my mind, +4 was like all 4 limbs in one piece of clothing, so like a onesie. But actually, +4s are baggy knickers reaching below the knee, worn especially by men for playing golf.
Interest.
So they're just big old underwear, long underwear for golf.
Oh, those golfers, they're crazy. I like that we both had the same idea here, but they mention like all these tents while they're walking up to the cottage to see Mr. Roberts. And there's a tent that's made of silk and it has peacocks just like hanging out at the front of it. And we're both like, the Malfoys, this is the Malfoys.
An excuse to be ostentatious and show off their wealth and be braggadocious and overly, like, flashy is 100% Malfoy energy.
Yeah. Well, I just feel like the peacocks really give it away because they have a thing about peacocks.
Freud might have a thing or two to say about that, but I'm not going to go there. One of the things I forgot to mention about the Malfoy tent is that there truly is nothing more subtle than a multi-story tent with exotic birds and a weather vane.
So I had a lot of issues with just like how they have Mr. Roberts, who I guess owns this property where they're camping. And obviously, like, I feel like the ministry should have prepared most wizards coming in because obviously there's the dress issues, but also just like the money. Like, Mr. Weasley doesn't know how to count the money and it's just very weird. Because he's obviously not foreign, and Mr. Robert is like, what's going on with you? You're suspicious.
Yeah, I honestly think it would have been way, way smarter if the ministry planned ahead in that regard. Like, I can tell some of the wizards just don't care enough to hide that they're magic. They're like, whatever, muggles aren't my problem. But I think some of them really tried to look like muggles and simply didn't have the necessary information to do so. And I think the ministry could have, like, negated a lot of the risk going on now if they'd sent out, like, a how-to muggle manual for wizards. And it could include things like pictures of an outfit or clothing that normal muggles wear, and like pictures of what the exterior of, like, a muggle campsite looks like, what their tents look like. These are the 5 most common pieces of muggle money. This is a 6p, this is a British pound, and this is how you add them together. Like, it could have been done in like 5 pages of manual, and it would have saved a lot of problems.
It just kind of shows how they don't, the ministry in general, just not really care about Muggle relations.
They're not, they don't care, they don't treat Muggle things like they're very important.
It's like a nuisance for them. They're just like, oh, we have to deal with these people. They want to keep the secrets, but they don't really want to, like, interact with Muggles. Yeah, but my whole thing about this is just, like, because Mr. Roberts obviously owns this thing, and instead of, you know, preparing better, they just, like, obliviate him, like, 3 or 4 times a day. And, like, doesn't multiple memory charms, like, affect someone's brain, but they just don't care because he's a Muggle? And, like, why do they pick a Muggle-owned campsite? Why couldn't they find somewhere that was, like, abandoned or something? It was just, like... I don't understand.
I think that there's definitely, like, we know there are consequences to the Obliviate charm. We see what happens if it goes wrong with Gilderoy Lockhart. But something like that, in my mind, can't possibly not have long-term repercussions. Like, maybe short-term it's fine. But to me, that's going to lead to, like, increased, like, memory issues in the future. They're going to have formed so many memories that they've lost that they're going to struggle to know the difference between things they've imagined and things that happened. Trouble processing and storing new memories. It, like, almost like dementia-like symptoms, I think, would be the long-term repercussion of being frequently obliviated like that. And, like, there's definitely going to be health repercussions, but I highly doubt the Ministry of Magic goes back a few years later to check on people they frequently obliviated to make sure they're doing well because they just don't care. And it's really kind of horrible. And that's the kind of thing that there should be some sort of, like, magical regulations about. Like, if you, a Muggle needs to be around wizards for this amount of time, see this many level of this class things to be obliviated. This is the maximum amount of time you can obliviate a Muggle. If you reach the maximum, everyone that's around them that's magical, that's doing the events that they need to forget, has to leave. Like, there has to be some sort of laws in place to protect that Muggle. And I don't think there is.
Yeah, it's not great. But as they're, like, walking off to their campsite, the ministry wizards obviously are talking about obliviating Mr. Roberts and how Ludo Bagman's not helping because, you know, he's just talking about bludgers and stuff and, like, public and walking around in his wizard's robes. And Jenny brings up the fact that, like, shouldn't he, like, you know, be not doing that? And it just kind of shows that he's just not great at his job.
It's also fun because we also get, like, to see things like the Weasleys arrive at their campsite and it's misspelled.
Weezy.
And that's so classic. Weezy, yeah, it's just funny. It's just very, it's funny that some of the wizards are there in advance so they can put up their silk tents and peacocks and other wizards don't get their name right. It's very reminiscent of the class system and how valued different employees are at the ministry.
It's also Mr. Weasley is just, like, very excited to do things the Muggle way. So he wants to, you know, go check in and have, like, he tries so hard. Which you gotta love. But Mr. Weasley's just like, yeah, we're gonna set up the tent, like, the Muggle way. But he asks Harry for all this, like, Muggle things, like, how do you do the money? How do you set up this tent, Harry? Like, Harry knows everything. But the fact is, like, he picked him up from the Dursleys. So, like, doesn't he know that Harry's just kind of, like, you know, like, locked in his room half the time? Like, Hermione's right there.
Yeah. I mean, maybe he just, I think he's closer to Harry than he is to Hermione.
That's true. Like, he just, I think this is the first time Hermione stayed over at the Weasleys.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know if he'd be comfortable asking her for help, if he'd know, like, if she's okay with that. But I also think Mr. Weasley doesn't know enough about camping as a whole to know if it's something that abusive aunts and uncles would bring their nephew to do. Like, he's like, I don't know, like, this is a fun recreational thing they do. I don't know if this is torture. I don't know. Like, it, maybe he just thinks all Muggles know Muggle things. Just like, even though Ginny can't apparate yet, Ginny knows about apparition because she exists in a world where people do it, you know?
Exactly.
Advanced math would just blow wizards' mind. That there's, like, all these advanced things Muggles know that other Muggles can't, like me, have no comprehension of. He'd be like, I don't understand.
Well, it's like he's assuming that all Muggles camp when camping is just a very divisive thing, I think. And I don't think the Dursleys are camping people.
They don't strike me as camping people, no. I think they strike me as not camping people.
They're definitely the type that would book a hotel.
Yeah, definitely hotel people. Not putting up a tent, being in the woods surrounded by bugs. Like, Petunia is too, like, organized and tidy and obsessed with neatness to be able to be surrounded by dirt and mosquitoes.
They would pay extra to stay in, like, some kind of, like, fancy lodge where you would get, like, the rich people experience of camping, but not, like, yeah, let's, like, you know, set up a tent and cook on a fire.
Yeah, they're not roughing it, that's for sure. Also, Harry mentions that he never went on a trip with the Dursleys because he would stay at home with Miss Fig, which is interesting that she comes around and becomes semi-important later on.
So my one thought reading this is that I need a wizard tent because the housing situation in Canada, especially Ontario,
garbage,
is nuts. And I think I should just get this wizard tent, which is basically my apartment in a wizard tent, you know, pitched up on some land somewhere and, you know, just live my life without paying rent.
Honestly, yeah, you could buy an acre of affordable land somewhere and stick a magic tent on it. I bet they're winterized too, you know, because magic.
Exactly.
I love that it looks like a normal tent-ish from the outside, the traditional ones anyway, and how huge. It's very much like a bigger version of Hermione's purse we hear about later on.
Yes.
And that's just fun. I love, like, if you're a Doctor Who fan, the TARDIS of it all, that it's bigger on the inside. It's just fun and kooky and, like, the right kind of magic to get me excited about the whimsy.
Harry and Hermione are just kind of like, how are we all going to fit when, like, Bill, Charlie, and Percy get here, and Mr. Weasley is like, oh, we're gonna be a bit cramped, but it should be okay. And then come in, they're like, what the fuck? And Mr. Weasley's like, yeah, it's okay, right? Like, I know it's not grand or anything. And they're just like, this is a tent.
He also has no idea, right? Like, he's like, this is a tent. Wizards go camping in these tents, and Muggles go camping in these tents. Therefore, Harry and Hermione, coming from people with slightly more money than us, must have nicer tents than this. He doesn't realize that, like, they were expecting it to be the size of the exterior in his mind. He's just like, of course it's not that. Who would sleep in that?
It's just like the kooky moments that I love. It's so much fun.
It's giggly.
So while they're, like, in this, like, campground, Harry's kind of realizing, like, how big the Wizarding World is, which is really funny, because I guess you don't really think about it as a kid. You're just, like, really focused on, like, your circle, like, your what's going on around you. And it's like the first time Harry's like, wow, look at all these wizards. There must be thousands of wizards in the world.
Yeah, he's shocked that he's like, oh yeah, they come from other countries. I guess that checks out. Sure, why not? But it is neat that we're always expanding the world every book. You know what I mean? It goes from one wizard to one class of wizards to one school of wizards to there's a ministry, there's a government, a whole country of wizards. And now there's a whole other countries of wizards.
There's the entire world.
Yeah. I feel like book 7, we should have learned about alien wizards. Like, we should have got off planet wizards. If we were continuing the rate of, like, expansion, I want to know about Saturn wizards. Tell me about the wizards on Pluto.
Pluto's not my planet anymore, though.
Shh, don't talk to me about that.
But Harry, Ron, and Hermione are sent to go get water. So they're, you know, getting, like a nice little view of, like, all the wizards waking up. And Harry gets to see the little kid wizards for the first time. And my first thought is that wizard toddlers must be more of a nightmare than, like, regular toddlers, because they have, I guess, uncontrolled magic, or they can, like, steal their parents' wands and stuff, as we see of, like, this little kid, Kevin, who's, like, growing this slug.
Yeah. All the, like, mayhem that traditional, normal toddlers can get up to, like, spilling soup all over, throwing dishes, playing in mud, doing all kinds of weird things that kids do. I don't know. I don't have one. But I'm assuming they make big messes. But with magic and the ability to, like, do the amount of damage magic can do with the lack of, like, conscientiousness of repercussions that toddlers have is insane. But it's also interesting that they do decent magic. Like, enlarging a slug is something that Harry didn't even learn in his first year. Like, that's, like, in my mind, like, second year magic. It's so interesting how young wizards start to be able to do magic.
Yeah. Almost has something to do with, like, the nature versus nurture, that they're raised in, like, this, like, with magic as soon as they're born, so they must be able to kind of, like, just do things.
Yeah, the monkey see, monkey do. Like, just sort of doing the mimicking of their parents' behaviors leads to them doing some magic, I guess. Yeah.
One of my favorite things is that they walk past, like, a group of witches that are American, and they have a sign that says the Salem Witches Institute, which makes me think about so many things. I just about America and how, like, the schools and just, like, how the Wizarding World's different there.
Yeah.
Obviously ignoring everything from Fantastic Beasts.
We don't talk about it.
But I wonder, like, how different schooling could be in America, because we don't know if this is, like, a women's club, if it's a sorority, if it's a school. So the idea that, like, maybe they have separate wizard witches schools, and, like, would the schools in America be boarding schools? Because that does feel like more of, like, a European thing.
There are some boarding schools in, like, the States. I've known a few people who went there for like sports.
But then there's also the idea that like America is so big, it has a huge population compared to like Europe.
Yeah, I wonder if like in my mind, America is like slightly less boarding school-y. So maybe kids commute to school, but like via flu network or something.
Yeah.
Because you like to me, if Hogwarts wasn't no disapparating rules and just like allowed easy flu access, you could just like flu powder into school every day. So like maybe they live at home and flu powder in.
Yeah, that's what I could see. Because most schools, I feel like there's some like richy schools that I feel like they have the option to board. But I feel like in America, it's more just like you go to school and you come home.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's just like the way things are done here.
I have questions as someone who went to Salem last year. It was beautiful, by the way. I highly recommend it for anyone who's interested. Also, make sure to also look into their very interesting pirate history, which is greatly underappreciated because of how hyped the witch stuff is. But both are great. I think it's really interesting thinking about historical events that involve witch, quote unquote, witches in history and looking at that in the context of the Harry Potter books. Because like, the witches that were killed in Salem, whether they were crushed to death, whether or not they were hung, or in Europe where they were burned at the stake and stuff. I mean, those things, you can easily get out of that situation as a witch. You can disapparate. You can do a bit of wandless magic enough to get away from a couple muggles. Like, so to me, in the world of Harry Potter, none of those deaths happened, and it was witches, because Harry Potter's kind of kitschy and gooky and kooky and funny. So in my mind, they let the muggles think they were killed. And then they just separated back to where they were all hanging out as a coven and laughed about how much the muggles thought they had destroyed the witches when they're just like having a laugh. Because I think that to me is the most appropriate for this novel's like maturity level and vibe for what truly happened in Salem. So it's just a bunch of witches slightly revealing themselves for funsies, letting people think they killed them for funsies, laughing about it.
Yeah, but it makes you just think about like the schools and how differing things, because Europe's a lot different and older than America and Canada. So I feel like the way we would do school and stuff here would be a lot different than how like the UK and greater Europe would do stuff.
Yeah, I feel like also like the housing system that Hogwarts has is a very British boarding school.
Yeah,
but I don't think that's a common thing at Canadian and American schools.
Yeah, no, it's not.
So I think like, I feel like there would be maybe more smaller schools in my mind in America, just because it's so spread out. They have to kind of have them closed for flu purposes. And then in my mind, for things like school level Quidditch, they would actually play other schools rather than teams that exist within the same school. So I feel like that would be a bit different.
Kind of just like how normal like American schools and like schools up here would do stuff. Yeah, but it's just interesting to think about. But also they run into Seamus, who brought Dean to the Quidditch World Cup, which I thought was really sweet.
I mean, look, you know, the Weasleys brought Harry and Hermione, Seamus brought Dean. That's how you do it. You bring your pals.
Yeah. It's just nice to get to run into like all like their friends and stuff. And that Dean, who's really, I think in the book, he's really into like football.
Yeah.
Like muggle football. So Seamus bringing him to like an actual Quidditch game, like a proper
English muggle football. not American football.
It's different. And then they get a first look at like the Irish supporters have their tents covered in shamrocks, and then they're like, well, look what the Bulgarians have, and they just have a picture of Crumb.
Just Crumb, angry face, grouchy, doing his serious face. I will say, like, I've definitely seen like when hockey teams release like the annual like photos of their players and stuff for like press to have, this is the headshot of him we put up when he scores or whatever. A lot of them try and do a mean mug, like, I'm tough, I'm scary. So like, I absolutely picture it perfectly.
I just think Crumb's just very uncomfortable with attention. Like, we know he's kind of shy and introverted, so I just feel like he doesn't photograph well because he's just like uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Which, relatable.
But also, I think the Bulgarians probably prefer him looking scary and intimidating. So, like, I'm not sure that, I don't think they're saying, now a goofy one, you know, when they're taking pictures.
It's funny because Hermione's first opinion of Crumb is that he looks really grumpy, which is, like, very relatable. Because I feel like whenever my brother shows me, like, these really great, like, athletes, I'm just like, oh, they look like this. Or I just, like, I don't get it because I don't get sports.
Yeah, exactly.
And Ron is just, like, so, like, offended. He's like, he looks grumpy. He's like the best Quidditch player in the team, and he's only 18, and he's just like this amazing person.
Doesn't matter if he looks grumpy. Really funny to see Ron fanboying over his athlete, you know?
Which is funny how things change later in the book.
Oh, the turntables.
Probably my favorite part of this entire chapter is Archie. Justice for Archie. He is the old man who is wearing a woman's nightdress, and the ministry wizards are trying to get him to, like, you know, put some pants on, and he's like, no.
I hate pants. I respect him. I understand him. I relate to him.
All the wizards are wearing, like, mismatched clothes. And I'm like, if this house happening now, like today, I feel like people wouldn't really care because clothing now is so gender fluid. I just feel like there's a lot of different, like, people have different aesthetics. And it's not just like everyone's trying to, like, do trends. Like, there's different trends for different aesthetics. And I feel like everything's kind of like wear whatever you want these days. And especially like the gender fluidity where like there's not really like gendered clothes.
Yeah, men can wear dresses on the cover of Vogue and everyone's like, no, he looks pretty good.
And so like they're trying to get him to change because like, oh, only women wear those kind of clothes. But nowadays it'd be like, oh, if you want to wear a nightgown, do it.
Yeah, gender norms were definitely more rigid back then. And also I just think like style, like I think this is a big thing with like the fast fashion era. Well, now that clothes is made so fast and so quickly, people can go through style transitions faster where they go from being like, I'm kind of goth, all my clothes are black, to like, no, I'm leading into like a more of like a woodsy aesthetic. So I have a lot of greens and browns in my wardrobe now. And now I've gone full tilt and I'm going into like a neon emo phase where I've got everything in electric blue. And like, because of fast fashion, you can afford to switch things around. But I feel like the time when this is set, that wasn't really as much a thing. So you couldn't really, it wasn't smart to buy overly flamboyant pieces because you might not like them and you might not be able to buy a replacement soon because everything, things were like made and tailored and like, so there were a lot more like neutral pieces.
Yeah.
So I feel like even just like the muggles weren't wearing as much outlandish, crazy styles. So there was a lot more, they have a lot more limited options. And also I think like the British traditionally are very classy dressers. So there's a certain degree of like not too flashy about it. I mean, not for all of them certainly, but like the traditional British style in my mind is like beautiful peacoats, a nice blouse, jeans that fit right, a cute little boot. Like to me, it's very...
Yeah, like proper tailored trousers.
Yeah, exactly. So I think like the things they're finding are like pajamas that in my mind have bright flowers on them because mm-hmm. It's like it was your grandma's old nightie and it's a nightie so it can be bright and it's fine. And that's really shocking when everyone else is wearing gray tweeds.
Yes.
And slacks that are like cotton. Like it's just, it's a big, I can see why it's shocking to have them dressing like that. I can also see why a lot of the styles that they're describing, like a poncho and a kilt, wouldn't even surprise me now. Like,
yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised because you can try new things easier in fashion these days. And there are a lot more distinctive styles than there used to be.
I also think just post-COVID, people just don't care anymore.
Yeah.
I think that kind of took a lot of people to their limits. And nowadays, people just aren't surprised by like anything. They're like, oh, we've survived a worldwide pandemic.
Yeah, we've got bigger fish to fry.
If you want to wear a kilt and a poncho, go for it.
As long as you're comfy.
He also likes a, what did he say? He likes a healthy breeze around his privates. That's what he said.
I respect it.
But they also run into a few other people, and they run into Oliver Wood, who has said that he made the reserve team for, like, a proper Quidditch team.
Good for him.
Which is like, you know, follow your dreams.
Yeah, Oliver, you do you.
He lived and breathed Quidditch, and now he's on the reserve team. Harry also runs into Cho Chang and kind of, like, embarrasses himself by spilling water all down his front, which is, like,
classic Harry.
Iconic. And I think it's definitely kind of, like, planting seeds for the future of, like, Harry's being a bit more obvious about his crush, so like Ron obviously kind of picks up on it.
Classic 14-year-old boy seeing a cute girl energy. He forgets how feet work, he forgets how to breathe, he drops things.
Harry also sees a group of teens and then is also exposed to the fact that not only are wizards like all over the world, there are other wizard schools besides Hogwarts.
He didn't think. Like, I want to know if there are exchange students at Hogwarts. Like, are there students at Hogwarts that aren't English, Irish, Scottish, Welsh? Because that would be interesting. And because Harry kind of seems like an idiot if he assumes there's only wizard children in the UK. Like, he just saw a bunch of wizards, international wizard adults, and he was like, okay, cool. And now he's like, oh, wow, other wizard children. And like, well, they had to start out before they could become adults. Like, that's how it works.
It's just like a teenager thing. Like, you don't think about things until you're kind of forced to. Everything's just like in your own little bubble that everything makes sense. And then you see something and you're like, oh, I guess this must exist like outside of like myself. So back at the campground, Mr. Weasley's getting like the fire started and where they're situated, there's all these ministry wizards kind of going back and forth doing their jobs, and they always say hi to Arthur and they like speak really nicely to him. So I kind of think it shows that even though Arthur is not in like an important department, or he isn't climbing the political ladder, he's still very well respected in the ministry just by, like, you know, being a good person.
Yeah, I feel like he's just a nice guy. And I feel like he's the kind of person where, like, if you say, hey, Arthur, can you help me with this thing real quick? He'll help you with the thing.
Yeah.
And I feel like a lot of people who go into politics are probably, or government, are probably very, have a lot of ambition, or always thinking a few steps ahead, are planning. You ask them for help and they're thinking, what will I get in return? Okay, I'll help you here, but then you have to help me there. And I don't think Arthur's like that. And I think maybe that's kind of a rarity.
Yeah, so it's just easy. He's very well connected, despite, I think, even his kids and other people saying that he's not in like a good department. Like, but that's what he likes to do. And he's just like, you know, a good employee and like a good person, and he'll help people out. And yeah, everyone speaks very highly of him. And
I bet everyone talks shit about each other to Arthur, because you have to be careful, right? Like, you can't talk shit about someone who outranks you to someone who might tell someone, because then you're in trouble. But you also don't want to talk shit to your coworkers about your coworkers. So in my mind, like, everybody complains about everyone else to Arthur because he's not high ranking enough to tell their bosses. He's just like, so they're like, you know, I really hate when this person does this. And Arthur's like, yeah, that sounds really annoying. I'm so sorry. And like, I feel like he's a safe person to do that with. So I feel like a lot of people are like, we love Arthur. He never tells anyone when we talk shit about them. And he's a helpful guy. And like, you don't have that fear of like, he's going to use everything I let slip against me in the future. He's just listening because you want a vent and he wants that for you.
Yeah, but reading that just made me think about in Order of the Phoenix, Percy, I think, and their fight they have, he calls Arthur out, but like how he had to like put up with his bad reputation in the ministry. But like, Arthur doesn't have a bad reputation here. Like, he knows so many people.
Maybe people treated Percy the way they treat Arthur, which is, help me with this thing, thank you. And they don't expect to be asked to do something in return. And so they treated Percy in a way that Percy thought was less than he deserved, which is fair. Like, Arthur decided he didn't really need anything in return when he did favors for people. And they're like, okay, that's the Arthur norm. And they just assumed that would be the same as the Percy norm, and it wasn't. But coming to Percy from that place made him think like, oh, I don't deserve you to help me. I'm not.
Percy wants to climb the ladder too. So I think it's just more the fact that like the way Percy views like his job at the ministry is a stepping stone, and Arthur just like likes his job and just, you know, goes into work and does his thing and goes home. But Percy wants to like climb the ladder.
And I'm sure people also assumed, having met Percy, like, or barely knowing him, that he's Arthur's son, that he's not going to be ambitious. So they didn't consider him early on for promotions or opportunities, because they're like, oh, we should give it to one of the wizards who wants it. Oh, no, that's Weasley's kid. Okay, Weasley's kid probably just likes his job and is happy to be here. Let's not worry about him. And Percy had to like sort of work at his job to prove himself, but also work at his job to prove himself as different than his father.
Yeah.
Even in ways that aren't bad about Mr. Weasley, but they're just different than the way Percy is. And he had to show people that and get them to understand that. Like, as a younger sibling going into school, when teachers have already had your sibling, there's definitely a certain way teachers look at you. Like, my brother was like an athlete, so gym teachers got really excited to see my last name. And then they saw who I was as a person and they were disappointed. So like, I never had a gym teacher that liked me. And it wasn't that I was like a bad student or didn't try. It was just like they expected so much and were let down so much. I think that's a big part of how Percy felt.
Mr. Weasley points out some ministry officials that are from the Department of Mysteries, and he actually references Bode by name. And Bode and the Department of Mysteries play like a big part in the next book. So I thought that was really cool that it came up this early.
So we get to see a bit of the gambling situation going on, because it's a sporting event. And I'm sure if you've turned on a sporting event in North America in the past 2 years, you've seen 37 ads for how you can be gambling on that sporting event. So naturally, even in wizard sports, there's a whole lot of gambling going on. And it's really interesting because we get to hear some of the things people have put up, which is, some of it's just a bunch of money. The twins put in all their savings. But good old Agatha puts up half shares in her eel farm, which to me, that's like a full-time job, having any type of farm. And half shares seems like half of her income is being potentially taken. And she puts it on the game lasting a week. That's a big bet. That's betting a lot on a very specific thing. Like, to me, if you're betting a lot, statistically, you want to bet on something that's like pretty likely and not super specific.
Yeah, but my brother bets against the Leafs because he knows they're going to lose.
I mean, that's just smart. Not smart. Good for him. But I think it's interesting. And also, I follow an eel historian on Twitter. I'm sure other listeners do. Eel historian. And it's actually very interesting. Eels are really valuable. And back in the day, they were used as currency because of how significant they were. So like people like who worked lands and like a lord or a duke or like a, some member of the aristocracy owned the land, they could pay their taxes to that person in eels. So like it's not entirely out of the realm of reality for her to be offering eels.
Don't say that, we never teach you anything.
This is the Learning Corner with Shay and Dory, and we're here to tell you that eels are currency.
I also thought that like when Ludo brings up the idea about bets, that like does Mr. Rizzi kind of have an idea about Ludo, because he really is strongly against friend George gambling, and does he kind of have an idea that like he kind of knows that Ludo has a gambling problem?
I don't know if that's something Mr. Weasley would like think about. Like I think it's more,
it could just be that he thought they were too young, which is what he says, and his Molly wouldn't like it.
Yeah, and I think he, even if he thought Ludo was like a really swell guy, gambling is still risk, taking a risk with your money, and like he gambled a little bit just to like have some skin in the game, you know what I mean? Why not? It's like buying a lotto ticket. It's not a lot. Yeah, the twins are doing a lot, and that's not necessarily smart. So I feel like he's like, no, that's dumb, but somehow the twins do it anyway because hell hath no fury.
That kind of leads into a whole side plot.
Oh, we're going to get there.
Another thing I love is the juxtaposition between Mr. Crouch and Mr. Begman. It's excellent.
Oh my gosh, it's hilarious.
We have Ludo, who's just, we'll talk about Ludo a bit later, but he's just all like fun and games and kind of like washed up like sports prodigy. And then Mr. Crouch, who's just all serious. And Harry even like says that even Vernon wouldn't even know that he was a wizard because he dresses so perfectly.
I think it's also interesting because despite being polar opposites, neither of them is likable, which I think is impressive. Like to manage characters that are so different, yet also I don't want either of them at my barbecue. Like they're not invited, either of them.
Of course, Percy is just so excited that Mr. Crouch is there. We get like kind of his like hero worship. He kind of like half bows to Mr. Crouch, which is like just so Percy. But we're, oh my God, Percy. It's just like, I gotta remember that he's only like 19. So like this is his first like real job. This is basically like his mentor. And we know that Mr. Crouch is like really big in the ministry. So like obviously Percy's like wanting to make a good impression. But Mr. Crouch does not know Percy's name.
Yeah. He also gets referred to as Weatherby. Yeah. Mr. Crouch thinks Percy Weasley's name is Weatherby.
I get so much secondhand embarrassment.
And it's so funny, but it's so sad.
Yeah.
And it's so sad that the twins hear it. It makes it so much worse. It makes it so much worse. And like, it's Percy, first of all, respects Mr. Crouch as like a stepping stone, obviously, as you said, for like, this is a very important, influential person. If I impress him, he'll tell other people. He's an excellent reference to have going forward in my career. But also, I think based on the fastidiousness and the rule following and like the tidiness, like a lot of the things about Mr. Crouch are actually things Percy admires. So like, he's not just like, this person is a tool for my career. He actually really admires Barty Crouch.
Well, I think that's, it's like, he wants him to mentor him. Like he wants to be what Mr. Crouch is.
Yeah. And so like, not only did his boss basically devalue him by showing he doesn't even know his name, but it's also someone he likes. You know, it hurts extra.
Also a little tidbit of Mr. Crouch bringing up this idea of just like magic carpets. And how this guy wants to export into the UK. And I think that I think last episode talked about how I didn't like flying because I'm gonna have a fear of heights, but I think on a magic carpet, I would be okay.
Less wedgie inducing, certainly, than a broom.
More comfortable.
I think it's really interesting, the magic carpet subject, because I think like magic carpets are like a magic transportation device that is not generally considered like English, British, European. Like it's from a completely different part of the world is where like the culture where that type of magic exists, you know? So it's really interesting to think that like other countries have a type of transportation that was once accepted in the UK, and now the government, the English government, is like minimizing or banning them. And it makes me wonder, like I doubt it's a safety issue if they're very common in other countries. I bet it's a controlling the market issue. Like there are no British, English, Irish, Welsh, Scottish carpet making companies, and none of those people are donors or friends to the British government officials. So like it's not beneficial to have English money being spent on those goods. They'd rather make it easier for their friends who make brooms and flue powder. You know what I mean? Like I bet it's like It's like they've created these regulations that make it harder for the importing of goods so that more people will buy the local goods.
Yeah, I mean, Mr. Weasley says it's because, like, carpets are a muggle artifact and all this stuff, but your way does make sense.
You could make it different than a carpet. Take the idea of a carpet, but have a chair be physically a part of it, like with a, and then it's not a carpet anymore, because if you put that on your floor, you'd trip and fall. So it's obviously not a carpet. It's just carpet-esque.
So wrapping up the end of the episode, we're going to talk a bit about Ludo Bagman, the man of the hour.
So he is so believable to me. It's hilarious. Like, he is the typical former athlete who gets a job he is not qualified for. He's a security risk, and it is so realistic. Like, it is so realistic. It's like, and he also has a huge lack of maturity. And I think that's also something you see in someone who either A, was really good at a sport early on, and people prioritize that in their life and therefore deprioritized other things. And you can also see it not just in athletes, like kids who are really good at like an instrument or like any type of prodigy.
You see it in child actors too, that like they're so in demand when they're kids. And then as soon as they hit like puberty, like the jobs just dry up and they're not prepared for that usually. So at one time they're like super in demand, they're super popular, and all of a sudden there's like cricket, there's nothing. And so it's like that kind of like screws them up.
Yeah, definitely. And I think in like the case of someone like him, it doesn't even sound like he was like, you can see that he's still very childish and young. So to me, there's a lot of like adult situations that would interfere with his ability to like make it to all of his Quidditch practices and stuff. So other people took those responsibilities for him. And so he didn't learn a lot, like budgeting, probably does not know how to balance whatever he pays in rent or mortgage with however much money he made on the Quidditch team. Like, he had to have people for all of those things. And you can tell by the way he interacts with things and the fact that he really isn't the most competent in a lot of other areas of his life. And then the fact that people seem to love him and celebrate him because of something he did years ago and how he played his sport years ago, regardless of how bad or much of a risk he is to his current employer. And it's just so funny how that happens, like the gildedness you have for someone who was once great.
There's a moment in the book where Ludo sits down with them and he's just like, oh, yes, there's nothing left to do. Everything's going great. And in the background, there's like ministry wizards like running back and forth trying to like put out fires and stuff.
Yeah, it's almost like they hired him a little bit because people would love him and there'd be a lot of goodwill towards the department, but they didn't expect him to do much, or they hoped he'd do a little and he's still not doing that much because he doesn't know how to be an official. He's a Quidditch player and he didn't know what to do when he retired, which is a huge problem for a lot of athletes, I'm sure. There's a physical time limit where you can no longer play the sport. Your body is tired. And that's all he's ever done, so he doesn't know what else to do. So like, people are giving him these positions because they loved to watch him Quidditch. And now they're watching him govern, or they're watching him government, like be the head of an important government body.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like how like washed up athletes and stuff are kind of given jobs in like organizations because they're like a spokesperson, like they have like popularity, so they know people will.
They have a recognizable face and there's goodwill towards them regardless. So people just want like the secondhand goodwill of having them around. But he is not qualified for the job. And I do not think, and he does things that are bad. He should not be gambling with children. He should not be ripping people off. And yet he gets away with so much just because he used to be good at Quidditch.
Yeah, it shows the kind of like how we idolize celebrities and athletes and stuff, despite the fact that they just do like a job, basically.
Honestly, if we think about it, like Sidney Crosby and Connor McDavid are some of the best hockey players in the men's hockey playing world at the moment, and they make millions of dollars a year. But like, I don't know if I would want them filing my taxes. I don't know if I'd want them in the Senate trying to give a speech on the importance of energy efficient taxation that encourages good environmentalism. I don't know. Like, I think being very good at hockey does not necessarily mean they would be good at other things equally. I don't believe that, but it seems like it's something that generally people forget.
Yeah, seeing just like Crouch and Ludo together, it just seems that Ludo's that guy you get stuck with for a group project that adds like transitions to the PowerPoint, and then during the presentation he like throws glitter and like makes a big deal. Well, like you've done all the research and you put together the PowerPoint and you sourced everything, and then he's just like taking all the credit and he just kind of like shows up at the end.
That is honestly very much how Ludo Bagman seems to me.
I don't like Crouch, but I do feel for him having to kind of deal with Ludo, where he's basically doing everything and Ludo just kind of shows up.
Shows up and then takes credit if it's successful.
Exactly.
There's always that person, you know?
Well, do you have any other things you have to talk about before we wrap up?
I'm really excited for the Quidditch World Cup. It's going to be great. Go Ireland. I also am betting all my money on Ireland to win and Crumb to catch the snitch.
I'm definitely excited for the Quidditch World Cup next chapter because we've just like been building up to this for like the last 7 chapters. And also it was just nice to have a chapter where there was so much to like talk about and stuff, because I feel like in this book we've talked about how there's a lot of transitional chapters.
Yeah.
And we've just been kind of like waiting for things to happen, and now things are finally going to happen.
Yeah. I mean, we met important characters in this chapter. We went to a whole new location in this chapter.
There's lots of foreshadowing. We finally got to meet Mr. Crouch and Bagman.
Yeah, a lot of personalities, you know. It's fun. It's a chapter that's juicy. There's a lot to it. It's a fully dressed veggie burger.
Well, thanks for listening to this episode of Potter Revisited, and we'll be back for chapter 8, the Quidditch World Cup. Finally, place your bets. The game's happening.
Ooh, sports.
If you have any thoughts about this episode, you can reach us at PotterRevisitedPodcast@gmail.com or on social media at PotterRevisited. And we will see you next time.
Bye.